We are studying the United Kingdom of Saul, David, and Solomon. The people requested a king, not what God would have, but he acceded to their wishes, gave them fair warning about what would take place, what would be the case with this king that they desired. He selected a king. We have seen that king go from a good person, a humble person, to one of just the opposite. And at the in our last lesson, we see that Saul was very much afraid of David for some strange reason. In chapter 18, or not the last lesson, but a previous lesson, in chapter 18, verses 12, 15, and 29. In fact, in verse 29 of chapter 18 of 1 Samuel, it says that he was even more afraid. The more wisely David conducted himself, the more afraid Saul became of him. Though David had never given him any reason to be afraid of him, he had done everything that Saul wanted him to do. He had been there when Saul needed him, when the spirit, the distressing spirit came upon him. And nevertheless, because of Saul's problems, that he had his lack of trust in God and his lack of desire to do the will of God, he has become paranoid and become afraid of David, and continues to seem to get worse. He became, as chapter 18, verse 29 says, he became David's enemy continually. It wasn't an on and off thing. It was something that when it began, it just continued to build. He became David's enemy. David had not given him any reason to have enmity toward him, but nevertheless, it was his idea and his problem that he had that he didn't deal with. He didn't trust in God as he should have and didn't seek to do the will of God. And so this one who had been anointed as king to succeed him became his enemy on a continuing basis. David puzzled about this, and I believe this is in our last lesson. David puzzled about it. He said, "What have I done?" He was baffled by it. He couldn't understand why Saul was his enemy. He didn't understand blind ambition. It wasn't a part of his nature. It never was. He never did covet the throne, the crown. It was not something that he sought after. I thought about Herod as he later on in the history of the Bible history, we see Herod as being one who coveted power and authority and position of king. In fact, I remember about 20 years ago standing in this spot teaching a class on New Testament history and talking about one of the things that I learned from my study was the fact that Herod made a dangerous voyage to Rome over the Mediterranean Sea during the winter, something that just wasn't done. In order to get to Rome to curry favor with the emperor and get this position as king over Judah. And so this was just the opposite of David. He was not one who sought for power and position and things of that kind. David was mostly concerned about doing the will of God, pleasing God. And he did anything that Saul asked him to do. Whatever Saul wanted him to do, wherever Saul wanted him to go, David was willing to do that. So no reason for Saul to be to have enmity toward him, and no reason for Saul to suspect that David had enmity toward him, that is Saul. He didn't consider himself worthy to be the son-in-law of the king, even. A lot of people would have considered that to be a position to be grasped and to be desired. But David not only didn't seek for the position as son-in-law to the king, but he didn't consider himself to be worthy of that position. And now he's constantly fleeing. He goes to Ahimelech, and then he goes to Achish, the king of Gath, seeking refuge, seeking to get away from from Saul, fleeing from him. So David is constantly on the run from this point almost to the end of Saul's life. I think eventually Saul gave up the fight. Eventually he got the message that he was tilting in windmills, and so there was no point in him continuing it. But for a long time, a very long time, David was his enemy continually, and he and David had to flee from him. David had an advantage in his flight from Saul, and that in seeking to do the will of God, God was on his side, and so he didn't really have to worry. God had anointed him, had him anointed as king, and so God's will would be done regardless. But David had to do his part, and he continued to be on the run all this time because he was not going to, God was not going to just put a wall around him, I don't suppose, and he could just stay there, and nothing that Saul could do would harm him. So David had to do his part. Anyway, as we get into our lesson today, the 22nd chapter of 1 Samuel, we have chapter 22 through chapter 23, verse 14, as our study for tonight. David departed from there. He departed from Gath, from where he had gone to Achish, the king of Gath. Achish had seen the performance that David had done, indicating that he was a crazy man. He drooled and he scribbled on the wall and on the door. And Achish drove him out of his presence. And so David departed from Gath, and he escaped to the caves of Adullam. I don't know exactly where those were. You may know, but there were a lot of caves in that part of the country, and a lot of good places to hide. There are still these caves there, and this cave, no doubt, continues there to this day. I don't know whether anybody knows where it is. A lot of the sites that are spoken of in the Bible, people will say that's where it is, but we don't always know whether they're accurate or not. But he went there, and his father and his brothers, his family, the members of his family came to him. They went down when they learned of the fact that he was hiding in the cave of Adullam. And it was at this time that Psalm 142 was written, according to those who are scholars and know the things that when the various psalms were written. Apparently, the 142nd Psalm was written during this time, talking about his experiences as he had to try to hide from Saul, hiding in the caves of Adullam. Some think that the 57th Psalm was written during this time too, in some places at a later time, and so we'll take the later date and we'll mention that at a later time. But so many of the Psalms, as I was recently reading through the book of Psalms, just in my daily reading, as I've done so many times, I've seen how that David talked about his enemies chasing after him and lying in wait for him, and how he would trust in God to deliver him from his enemies. Not only did his father's house, his brothers, all of them, and the brothers, of course, some of them had to leave the army of Saul and his service and follow after David. Not only did the family of David go to him as he was hiding in the caves of Adullam, but other people did. Who were these other people that went to David as he was fleeing from Saul? Kind of people you'd like to have around you, I guess, right? I don't know. It's kind of odd that it was this type of people and yet they were the people that would have had some kind of grievance, perhaps against the king, and perhaps against the monarchy in general. It may have been seen through the setup of the reign of Saul and the reign of any person who would be king over Israel, as Samuel had warned them about things that were going to be true of the monarchy. And maybe they were the ones who saw the difficulties that choosing this path would have brought about. And so they were discontent about the situation. And so they were the ones that had left and gone to where David was, found where he was. About 400 people went to David. David, being concerned about his parents, his father is spoken of as being old and advanced in years, even when we first learn of him. So it would not be a very good place for him to live, hiding in caves, rocks, and things of that kind, that type of rough terrain. So David sought to make things better for him. So where did he go? Okay, he went over to Moab. It says Mizpah of Moab. I tried to find that on a map. I couldn't find it. Maybe some of you have. We know about the Mizpah in Israel, but I couldn't find Mizpah in Moab, but it's somewhere in Moab. And there may have been a number of reasons for him going over into Moab. And there, finding refuge for his father and other members of his family. One thing is might be the fact that Jesse was a descendant of Ruth, who was a Moabitess. He was a grandson of Ruth, and so there may have very easily been people that, if they had not known the family of Ruth, they may have heard stories of her and that loyalty that she had toward her mother-in-law and all those good things that we know about Ruth. So that might have entered into it. It also might be the fact the proximity of Moab. See the Dead Sea right there makes and the valley. Lowest point on the face of the earth that might have made somewhat of a barrier there that made it a little easier for someone to hide out and get away from Saul. May have been produced a much more difficult situation for Saul as he might have been trying to chase after David. Any number of reasons why he may have gone over into Moab. Apparently David had a pretty good relationship with the king of Moab. Perhaps it might have even had something to do with some enmity or some friction between the king of Israel and the king of Moab. A number of reasons that might be cited. But he took them over there, and it says that, till I know what God will do for me. He's always thinking about God. One of his psalms, it talks about wait on the Lord. He didn't try to go ahead and prejudge and make determinations without seeking the Lord's counsel and advice and will. I'm doing a lot of talking. If you have a comment to make, stick up a hand and maybe I might be able to see you. But anyway, he was one to wait on the Lord. He wrote about it in the Psalms, as did Isaiah. Wait on the Lord. Don't try to get ahead of it. And so he was wanting to see what God would desire that he do. So he brought them to the king of Moab. But the prophet Gad, who later is referred to as David's seer, at this point Samuel is kind of out of the picture. We don't hear a lot about Samuel at this point. And so this prophet by the name of Gad came to David, told him that he needed to get out of there, go back over into Judah, depart, go to the land of Judah. So he departed. He took it seriously. This was the word of God, though it came through the prophet. He came to the forest of Hereth. Don't know where the forest of Hereth is, and maybe that's a good thing. Saul didn't think to look there, so David was safe for a time anyway. But Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. He knew that kind of where they were, and so He's up there in Gibeah. It says Gibeah, and mentions Gibeah and a tamarisk tree in Ramah, which Ramah is just a little further north from Gibeah. Saul always seems to be under a tree. I don't know whether he's under there for protection or exactly what, maybe the shade, I don't know. But he's always got his spear in his hand. He doesn't trust in God. The evil spirit has come on him. He's distressed a lot of times. And he's as we've used the word, I guess, perhaps too many times, he's paranoid at this point. Thinks that there are enemies that are trying to get him. Even thinks that David, this faithful servant of his, is trying to get him. So he always has his trusty spear at hand. And all of his servants are standing around him. And he begins to let his imagination kind of run away with him. What did he begin to accuse these servants of doing? They were there. They were not out chasing after David. They were not deserting Saul. But he has this vivid imagination, and this imagination's persecution complex. What does he think that that they're up to, the servants? Yeah. And he kind of began to put words in their mouth, or he began to make accusations. Do you think the son of Jesse, I wouldn't even call him a name, I don't know if there's any significance to that or not, but he says, is he going to give you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? You think, I think he knows that David is the one who has been designated as the king, and he's saying to them, are you going to shift your loyalty to him, or have you shifted your loyalty to him? And is he going to give you a job? Is he going to give you a material things, a property, or something like that? Do you think he's going to do that? He's saying, if you think so, then you're badly mistaken. You need to stay with me. I'm the one that can benefit you. And he's not, because, well, you know, that's because he thought so highly of himself and so low of anybody that he considered to be opposed to him. And then he, as Greg has said, he began to accuse them of conspiring against him. I've known of people like that. No earthly idea that people were talking about him or anything like that. He just supposed they were. And I've known of people like that. I knew of a man that somehow or other his son had gotten into some difficulty, and somebody from the church talked to him about this son that had gotten into some difficulty. Rather than try to straighten the situation out and get the son back on the right track, the father got kind of angry with the church, and he would see two men standing talking, and he immediately concluded that they were talking about him and his situation. They would be talking about anything in the world, but in his mind, they were talking about him. And I've known of other situations of a young lady that was withdrawn from by a church, and she, people would try to get her to go back and make things right, make a confession, get her life straightened out. Oh no, those people down there, they just talk about me awful. Fact is, they were not talking about it or awful. They were talking about, if they said anything about her, they were wanting her to repent and change her way. But her idea was, those people down there are doing this. She knew, though she wasn't anywhere around what was being done. She had already figured it out. And so Saul has figured it out that his son has turned against him, and he's told details as to what his son Jonathan has done. He's made a covenant with the son of Jesse. So what? Is there something wrong with making a covenant with somebody else? You have a friend, you make a covenant with it. Is there something wrong with that? Persecution complex indeed. And he goes on and says, not one of you who is sorry for me. I reckon he kind of whined when he said that. I kind of get the picture. None of y'all are sorry for me. Or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant. You know, did you know he had done that? Saul seems to be the only one that knows it. He stirred up my son against me to lie in wait as it is this day. That's what he's doing. He's lying in wait for me. David is lying in wait for me. Oh, he's running all over the country to get away from him, but he's lying in wait for him. I've read this many times, but I guess the more intense study that I put in on it this time has made me I'm glad I got my blood pressure medicine that I take every night, because it would raise my blood pressure just a little bit. I'm glad that I remember that vengeance belongs to God and not to me. I'm glad that even though these things are, these things are written, centuries ago, things that happened long before I came on this earthly scene, and yet they disturbed me very much, the audacity of a person who would make these statements, that David has stirred, and it gets worse, of course, as you study this lesson. David is lying in wait for him. My son has stirred him up, wanting him to turn against me. Well, it just happened that among those servants that were standing around, there was a man by the name of Doeg the Edomite. We ran into him back there in our previous lesson over at Nob, in the presence of Ahimelech, the priest. And Doeg the Edomite speaks up, and he's a person who likes to be on the side of the one who seems to have the upper hand. And incidentally, the 52nd Psalm seems to have been written regarding this time when Doeg the Edomite tells on or makes up some stuff about Ahimelech the priest. He said, "I saw." He tells incidentally, he at this point is spoken of as being the one who's set over the servants of Saul. He was over the servants of Saul. Earlier, he was the chief of the herdsmen, and I guess he's gotten a promotion or something. And he's a climber. He likes to climb the corporate ladder. He tries to get in a better position, and he uses whatever unscrupulous means of getting to that point. And so he begins to tell on Ahimelech. He said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub." And he kind of lets his imagination run wild with him. He's told that much about it, and so now he decides he'll just tell something that didn't happen, but it'll make it sound better anyway, won't it? And he, that is Ahimelech, inquired of the Lord. That's a terrible thing to do. Inquired of the Lord for him. He gave him provisions. He gave him a sword. Can you imagine what a terrible person that would be that would actually give somebody something to eat? That is a result of some sort of conspiracy. I'm reminded of Dr. Mudd back the night of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. I don't know. I wasn't there. Don't know whether Dr. Mudd knew anything about what was going on, whether he knew anything about the plot to kill the president. But here goes John Wilkes Booth riding through the night and stops off there with his broken leg. And Dr. Mudd, of course, I guess had taken the Hippocratic Oath that he would try to heal whatever illnesses and injuries that came to him. I won't try to quote the oath because I probably wouldn't remember all of it, but basically that's what it was, to help people, to not do any harm. And so he set Booth's leg, and Booth went on his way. And Dr. Mudd spent several years in prison because he was supposed to be part of this conspiracy. Again, I'm not going to get into that discussion. It's been going on for centuries, I guess, or a couple of them. One and a half, anyway. Let's say it that way. I have to get my dates correct. But somebody does something good for somebody, and it happens that because the one that is the recipient of that good is the enemy of somebody else, then the one who did good for him also becomes an enemy. If you can follow all that, what is in the mind of some to be logic. Well, he gave him provisions, he gave him a sword, the sword of Goliath. Well, David was a military man. He was a captain of a thousand. So sometimes people like that wear swords, don't they? And it happened that it was the sword of Goliath. David had some claim to that sword, did he not? Remember the deed that David did that benefited Israel and benefited Saul personally to a great extent. And yet, the fact that he was given this sword that had belonged to Goliath, and whom David had slain, that made him a part of some conspiracy in the mind of Saul, and of course Doeg the Edomite, being the low life that he was, desired to use this to gain some favor in the sight of Saul. So Saul called Ahimelech the priest, all his father's house, all those priests that were in Nob, and they all came to the king. They were not, apparently they didn't know anything was wrong. They hadn't done anything wrong. They came, and Saul says, "Hear now, son of Ahitub, you listen to me." And Ahimelech says, "Here I am, my lord. I'm here. What do you want?" He's not rebellious. He's not being disrespectful. He's there. I'm ready to deal with whatever you have for me. And so Saul begins to make his accusations again. "Why have you conspired against me?" Huh? What is he talking about? "Why have you conspired against me?" He didn't know he had. And of course, Saul continues to pile it on. "You and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread." Again, what's wrong with that? That's not a conspiracy. That's not an evil deed. "And you've given him a sword." We've talked about that. "And have inquired of God." Something wrong with inquiring of God? Maybe if it had taken place, what would be wrong with inquiring of God? They were the people of God. David had done what he did because he trusted in God. He had killed Goliath because God was with him, because he had faith in God that God would strengthen him and give him success. What would be wrong with inquiring of God? Well, when you're an enemy of God, then I guess it becomes, to the mind of the person like that, an evil thing. So, and again, and all the things that Doeg the Edomite, this great statesman, this great servant, the Edomites, were they friends of Israel? No, they weren't friends of Israel. What was he doing there in the first place? What was an Edomite doing there among God's people? Read the book of Obadiah, I'm sure you have. They were not the best of friends of the Israelites, and so he was certainly not Saul was not in good company. But again, the accusation that David was lying in wait, as it is this day, it's true. It's validated. He is sure of it. Well, Ahimelech, puzzled as he is, answered the king, says he's trying to show that David, first of all, he talks about David and his loyalty, the fact that David wouldn't be doing a thing like this. "And who among your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in all in your house?" All these great attributes that David had that Saul should have been proud of, and Saul should have seen the sterling character of David. And then he begins to talk about his own complicity or lack of it in this case. "Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it. I didn't do anything like that." Do you remember reading about anything like that when we studied about the encounter with Ahimelech? I don't remember anything like that. Let not the king impute anything to his servant. I don't think he's saying, "Don't you accuse me of that." I think he didn't put it in that way, but says he's saying, don't tell me I did that, because I didn't do it. Don't impute that to me. don't impute anything to his servant, or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all this, little or much. I didn't know all about it. I didn't know a little bit about it. Then the king, of course, was very impressed with that speech and let him go, right? He wasn't going to let him go no matter what he said. He said, you shall surely die. Ahimelech, you and all your father's house. I'm not going to just kill you, I'm going to kill the whole bunch. And so he told the guards, those bodyguards of his, standing around, and this is one of those things that kind of raises my blood pressure just a little bit. Told those guards, turn and kill the priest of the Lord. Kill the priests of the Lord. He wasn't talking about malefactors. He wasn't talking about murderers. Somebody like Barabbas. Kill the priests of the Lord because of what they have done to me. You know, because their hand is with David. And because they knew when he fled, they knew about it. They knew he was fleeing. They knew the whole story. And they didn't tell me about it. And that, therefore, they're worthy of death. But the servants wouldn't lift a hand to do that. Good for them. They just stood there. Not going to do it. But who could he depend upon? Do his dirty work. Good old Doeg the Edomite. And he turned to him and he said to him, you turn and kill the guards that wouldn't kill the priest. Is that what he said? Thought I'd pull a Clark Busby on you there. Still miss that old boy. He had a way of teaching that I admire and wish I could do it like him. He would ask a question like that and then look to see if everybody was listening. He didn't say go and kill the guards, because can you imagine what would have happened if he had raised his sword to one of them? No more Doeg the Edomite. This little coward, we could call him several things that we won't, but he goes over and he starts killing these docile, unarmed priests and just killing them one after another. 85 of them. And he didn't stop with that. He was a good soldier. He was a good servant. He went to Nob, the city of the priests, and struck with the edge of the sword both men and women, children, nursing infants. I'm sure they'd be a big threat to Saul's throne when the nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, everything that he could find that breathed, he killed it. Pity that Saul didn't send Doeg the Edomite down to destroy the Amalekites. Well, even if he had, he wouldn't have been totally successful, although it wouldn't have been because he wanted to spare somebody, would it? Why was he not totally successful? Abiathar escaped. Now, one thing we need to notice is that this was carrying out a prophecy back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, where the house of Eli was told that they would eventually be destroyed because of the sins of Hophni and Phinehas. And there would not be an old man in that family eventually. And Doeg the Edomite was the instrumentality by which this was to take place, or did take place. But it wasn't because he wanted to do the will of God or carry out a prophecy of God. He just wanted to curry favor with Saul. But anyway, Abiathar did escape, and he came and he told David, he found David, told him about what had taken place. And David, being the honorable person that he did, he didn't say, it wasn't my fault. He said, I knew that he'd go tell Saul about that. That day I saw him over there when he was with Ahimelech. I knew he'd go tell him. I guess he didn't have any idea that it would turn out the way that it did. But he said, I've been responsible. I've caused the death of the persons of your father's house. But he said, you stay with me and you'll be safe. So David was going to do the honorable thing and admitting that he had made a mistake, but he was also going to protect Abiathar from any harm. Well, then they told David something in chapter 23. Look, the Philistines are fighting against Delilah. That's a name that we're not all that familiar with. At least I haven't been. I've read it a number of times, but it just never has registered with me. And that seems to be the pronunciation of it. It's not one of those that you'd want to write in your book for future reference or find other references to it. It's not a great deal said about it. It's not a household name. But Delilah, three syllables, the middle syllable having the accent on it. The Philistines are fighting against this little city, and they're robbing the threshing floors. They were warlike people. They seemed to rather fight than work or do anything else. And so they're robbing the threshing floors. That's one way they made their living, was fighting, taking what other people had. Therefore, as David always did, he inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines?" The Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines." Two things he told him. Attack the Philistines, save Keilah. Here he has, by this time, about 600 men. You suppose the Philistines had a few more than that? You remember reading about their army back a few weeks ago. We were studying about this. They had, it was either 4,000 or 40,000 chariots and all these horsemen and soldiers of one kind or another as the sand of the sea. So I have an idea that David and his 600 men were greatly outnumbered. And David's men seemed to realize that they were at a grave disadvantage. And they said, we're afraid here in Judah. Can you imagine what it would be like if we faced the armies of the Philistines? Well, David then inquired of the Lord again. And the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines in your hand." Doesn't make any difference. You remember the statement that Jonathan made about with many or few, David, God was assuring David that it didn't require great numbers to defeat the army of the Philistines. And so he said, "I'll deliver them into your hands." And so he went to Keilah, fought against the Philistines, struck them with a mighty blow, took away their livestock. They were going to enrich themselves by attacking and robbing the people and the threshing floor of the people there in that little city, but they wound up losing their livestock. David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. And it happened that Abiathar had come down and he had bought the ephod. He being the priest, he had bought the ephod. And Saul at this time, though, has been given some intelligence regarding what's going on, that David was in Keilah. And so he makes a ridiculous statement. After he has commanded his guards to kill the priests of the Lord, didn't make any difference to him that they were the priests of the Lord. Then he makes the ridiculous statement, "God has delivered him, that is David, into my hand, for he has shut himself in, by entering a town that has gates and bars. He's trapped. He's painted himself into a corner here. And so I've got him now. He's not hiding up in the mountains and the wilderness or in the caves or anything like that where it's hard to find him. He's right here. I know where he is." And so he thinks that he's finally got David. He calls the people together. But David has Abiathar bring the ephod, and he inquires of the Lord. He says, "Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake." He's going to destroy this city. Didn't make any difference what the obstacle. Priests of the Lord, a city of people, men, women, and children. He's going to destroy this city just to get me, seems to be the idea. Well, and so he inquires of the Lord, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me? And will Saul come down and as your servant has heard?" Well, the Lord only answers the first question to begin with. Yes, he will come down. But that question about these people that David had delivered from the Philistines, will they tell on me? Will they give me up? Well, they ask that question, and they will deliver you. That's how they'll show their gratitude for you delivering them from the Philistines. So David and his men, about 600, arose, departed from Keilah. You know, David got the message that Saul was coming, and so before, Saul, I guess, thought he was going to surprise him, catch him there in that city, trap him, and come down on him. But David inquired of the Lord by the agency of Abiathar and the ephod, and he learned that Saul was coming, and so David and his 600 men left and went wherever they could go. Didn't leave a forwarding address. They didn't say where they were going. They just went wherever they could find a place to hide. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he halted, it says in this version, the expedition. He stopped with that particular chasing of David. That one came to an end. But was that the end of everything? Was that the end of his trying to catch up with David? Keep it up, yeah. David stayed in the strongholds of the wilderness and remained in the mountains and the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day. He was preoccupied, you might say, as an understatement. Every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. God was not really with him, though he might have wished that he were. Appreciate your participation.